From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
Hi there. It's the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Luke Burbank.
I'm Allison Stewart. We're going to do this for 2 hours again, aren't we?
I guess. I don't know. I brought, like, the world's biggest cup of coffee. I brought a pack of Tic Tacs.
So I appreciate the Tic Tacs.
I know. I realized after, like, you know, a month and a half of doing this that I'm probably not that pleasant to be around after my ninth cup of coffee.
May I please have one while you tease the first thing in the show?
Absolutely. Speaking of show teases, we've got a little recap of the president's trip to Iraq that happened earlier this week. The reason we thought it was interesting among the geopolitical kind of implications was also the fact that none of the reporters who went even knew where they were going. They just were told to show up at Andrews Air Force Base and, like,
imagine?
Pack an overnight bag. And next thing you know, you're on a plane to Baghdad. Actually, he didn't go to Baghdad, other parts of Iraq. We're going to talk about that with a reporter who was on the trip.
We're also going to talk to a husband and wife. They've been in this country for 20 years. The wife spent the summer in jail, even though she's married to a U.S. citizen, based on she was supposed to leave the country 21 years ago, but she married a U.S. citizen, got a Social Security card. They're going to tell their part of the story and why she does not want to go back to Liberia.
There's big new music on the horizon. Next week in particular, Kanye West has a new record, 50 Cent. There's a Fats Domino tribute album. Led Zeppelin is getting back together. We're going to find out about all this stuff from Andy Langer, music writer for Esquire magazine.
And you might want to write this down. You might want to engage in strategic incompetence.
Believe me.
Yes.
I know it, and I live it.
It's part of cube culture. We're going to be talking to friend of the show, Jared Sandberg from the Wall Street Journal. We'll also have the debut of Rachel Martin as our newscaster in just a minute. But first, here's today's big story.
Speaking of Idahoans, Idaho Senator Larry Craig is back in the news today. Before we, though, get into the sort of latest chapter in this saga, let's take a quick trip down memory lane.
June 11th, the Republican senator is arrested at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport and charged with peeping and disorderly conduct after some allegedly sexually charged footsie in a men's room. August 8th, the 62-year-old Craig pleaded guilty to a reduced charge of misdemeanor disorderly conduct. He paid a fine. Now, once this all went public, the married father of adopted kids addressed the issue on Tuesday, August 28th.
I am not gay. I never have been gay.
Craig blamed the decision to plead guilty on bad judgment brought on by the overzealous reporting of the Idaho Statesman newspaper.
While I was not involved in any inappropriate conduct at the Minneapolis airport or anywhere else, I chose to plead guilty to a lesser charge in hopes of making it go away. That was a mistake.
Now, by Thursday of last week, Craig had resigned from his leadership positions on several Senate committees, but that wasn't enough to satisfy many of his Republican counterparts who pressured him for a full resignation. On Saturday, Craig had this to say.
To pursue my legal options as I continue to serve Idaho would be an unwanted and unfair distraction of my job and for my Senate colleagues. Therefore, it is with sadness and deep regret that I announce that it is my intent to resign from the Senate effective September 30th.
Of course, after that, we all kind of figured that Senator Larry Craig had tapped his foot on the old floor of the Senate bathroom for the last time, but not so fast.
Did you notice he said the word intent to resign? Well, this morning, there is word that he is reconsidering that intent and may fight for his name and reputation while holding on to his Senate seat. One of Craig's lawyers, also one of Michael Vick's former lawyers, says Senate precedent dictates that Senate does not consider misdemeanor private conduct to be a proper subject of inquiry, and he's saying the Ethics Committee's investigation should be dropped altogether.
Craig now says if he can clear his name in that Ethics Committee and in the Minnesota court, he may fight for his Senate seat. Sidney Smith, that's Craig's spokesman in Idaho, said yesterday, quote, "It's not such a foregone conclusion anymore that the only thing he could do was resign." So we'll keep you posted on this story as events warrant. Right now, though, we welcome the Bryant Park Project's new full-time newscaster and native Idahoan, the pride of, Twin Falls?
Idaho Falls.
Idaho Falls. Rachel Martin with the news.
Hey, Luke Allen.
This is NPR.
Hey, everyone. Very happy to join you all this morning. Let's talk a little about the news. So, what do you do when you don't like the grade your teacher gives you? Well, if you're the U.S. government, you go back and you ask her to change it. Yesterday, the government's accountability office, known as the GAO, released a controversial report showing a grim picture of the war in Iraq. But before the report was released, White House and Pentagon officials criticized it. They said it was too harsh, and they pushed for last-minute changes. The GAO rejected several of the Pentagon's suggestions and concluded that Iraq had failed to meet all but two of the nine security goals Congress set as benchmarks for improvement, and that only one of eight political goals had been met. But the report was recrafted to show partial progress for four benchmarks, including the elimination of havens for militia forces and the deployment of Iraqi army brigades to help secure Baghdad. Military leaders in Iraq say the report is flawed and factually incorrect. The top general in Iraq, David Petraeus, and the U.S. ambassador in Baghdad, Ryan Crocker, are expected to give their progress report to Congress next week. Meanwhile, President Bush insisted today during a trip to Sydney, Australia, that things are looking up in Baghdad. Bush is in Sydney for the annual Asian-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, or APEC, meeting. In a press conference with Australian Prime Minister John Howard, Bush staunchly defended the war and praised Australia for its military support in Iraq. That's something Prime Minister Howard has taken heat for at home. Authorities in Germany say three suspects arrested in a terror plot against an American airbase had enough explosive ingredients to make some pretty massive bombs. The two Germans and a Turk are appearing today in court on charges of planning imminent attacks on Ramstein Air Base that's used by U.S. and NATO forces, and on Frankfurt's International Airport. AP Berlin correspondent Dave McHugh says the group had enough explosives to do serious damage.
They could have made a bomb with the explosive power of something like 550 kilograms of TNT, which is about 1,200 pounds, so a very large bomb.
A German federal prosecutor says the three had trained in Pakistan with a group called the Islamic Jihad Union, described as a Sunni Muslim organization based in Central Asia. And just when you thought it was safe to go toy shopping again, toy giant Mattel has announced yet another recall. It's the company's third recall of Chinese-made toys in little more than a month because of excessive amounts of lead paint. That's just what you want in your kids' toys. On August 1st, Mattel's Fisher-Price division said it was recalling 1.5 million toys featuring characters such as Dora the Explorer, Big Bird, and Elmo. The latest recall covers 675,000 Barbie accessories sold earlier this year, but it should be noted that no actual Barbie dolls were included in the action. So, Luke and Allison, if your Christmas shopping lists include the fair dolls, never fear. You can go ahead with it. And that's the news. Back to you.
You know, we're going... First of all, Rachel Martin, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, Rachel Martin. Excellent debut.
Also, speaking of Christmas, we're going to talk about that this week. Is it today or is it an upcoming
show? It's today.
Okay, we'll get into that later. I'm sorry, Allison.
It's okay. You know what? Former Tennessee Senator Fred Thompson, he might actually be running for president.
Hey, welcome to Red State Update. My name's Jackie Brose.
I'm Dunlap.
And I tell you people what, it is a great day to be an American. Old Fred Thompson is finally running for president.
No.
Yes, he is. He come out and said it. He's
no,
running
he
for president.
No, he just made an announcement.
That he's running for president.
No, that he's going to announce that he's running for president.
All right, so he made an announcement.
Yes.
That he's
going to
make an announcement.
Yes.
That he's running for president.
Now you got
well,
it.
Good. When's he
going
to do that?
Next week.
Oh, yeah, during those Republican debates coming up. Yeah, you wait and see.
He ain't going to be on them.
Why?
He's too busy.
Busy doing what?
Announcing
that he's running for president.
It's been pretty much like that for
what?
The
what is that?
What
was that?
Oh, it's the Red State guys from YouTube. Have you seen these guys? I think they asked a question during the YouTube debate. They're pretty hilarious.
That's awesome. Okay, so.
Yeah, he's been playing hard to get, but Fred Thompson expected to deliver a webcast announcing he's officially running for the Republican nomination for president. Richard Wolf of Newsweek magazine joins us. Richard is actually standing out in front of the White House right now. So, Richard, what took Fred Thompson so darn long?
What's he done wrong? Or I didn't hear that. I'm
no,
sorry.
What has well, some people say he's done something wrong. What has taken him so darn long?
What's taken him so long? Oh, I thought you were one of the Red State guys again. what's taken him so long? Well, there has been a lot of turmoil inside his inner circle as they have tried to find anyone with any decent experience who isn't already snapped up by another campaign. But I think the real reason that he has taken a lot of time is because he didn't need to put in the effort right now. And as we explain at some length in our cover story this week, This is a man who conserves his energy for the fights he thinks are necessary. Now, some people say that's lazy. Some people who are closer to him think that's just smart. And that's why we have the cover line, lazy like a fox. But a lot of it is keeping his powder dry. And frankly, look at what he's doing tonight. While all the Republican candidates are scrapping for time in the TV debate, he's going to be on Jay Leno. Now, where would you rather be?
Good point. I think they probably have better catering at Leno. So why is there room for Fred Thompson in this race? Every time I see a debate, it looks like they're just trying to stick an extra podium on the stage for Ron Paul.
Right. He is not coming on as a prop. Look, the reason is that Republicans are deeply dissatisfied with their own crowd. Now, it may be that Republicans are always going to be dissatisfied at this moment because of the war, because of their feelings about President Bush. But truth is, none of these candidates have really taken off on the Republican side. And if you remember recently, there was that poll that showed the most popular response to which candidate you support among Republican voters was none of the above. So there is this contest to be the true conservative, to be an authentic conservative that doesn't have the cloud over them that Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney have, especially when it comes to that dreadful 2004 phrase, the flip-flop.
All right, Thompson's statement noted the campaign will have 15 days from the time of the announcement to file formal paperwork with the Federal Election Committee. So is it possible he could actually back out?
Well, it's possible. Anything's possible. Larry Craig resigned, and then he said he's
not. Exactly.
Anything is possible in politics.
That's three toe really taps. That means I'm getting back into the Senate, just so you know.
Exactly. So, you know, anything could happen. He could hunt for the Red October again. But really, as much as you can say that he's hiring people, he's serious, he's raising money, he's making all the announcements, he's in. And he has actually been in for a long time.
All right, I'm with Fred.com. That's where the announcement will happen, via webcast.
Provided, Richard, that he doesn't back out, Freddie Thompson could be spending some quality time in such locales as Flint and Laramie.
Right.
That's
right.
Because Michigan and Wyoming are a couple of the states that are trying to get early on their primaries and their caucuses. Why are they trying to do this?
Well, part of it is economic development. It's a kind of strange way, but apparently we in the media and the free publicity we bring is supposed to be a boost to some of these places.
They're literally doing it because of the money that media organizations spend putting up their reporters?
Reporters and the attention, the branding, the dreadful phrases that economic development staff think are so important. There's also a political ego in it that if you're a local official, you suddenly become valuable. You get all these calls from Washington, D.C., and you get people saying, I'm going to give you money to help you get reelected. So there's a lot of perks that come with this, but it's a pretty grubby game, and there's not it's become a ridiculous competition. I mean, judging by this, we could have the first votes in, well, next month. I mean, it's getting kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, because for those who somehow don't know this already, the traditional like states like New Hampshire and Iowa tend to be really early. These are not big, giant states with big, giant populations, but because they've always been first, they're really important. Some people would say maybe disproportionately important. How about a state like
right.
California or Florida, where you have lots of people, kind of a diverse
yeah.
population? And it sounds like those other states are saying, we're tired of waiting for the candidates to go dance with these so-so girls.
Yeah, and look, there's an argument for that, and that's why the national parties have tried introducing a couple of other states between Iowa and New Hampshire. They are not representative places, Iowa and New Hampshire. They are smaller, that's true, although Iowa takes forever to drive across, believe me. the idea here is that you have a smaller state so that it's not just a big money candidate who can be competitive. If you start out in Florida or California, these are big media markets. It costs a huge amount to get up on the air, multiple media markets in Florida. So to be competitive, it would cost a huge amount. But you really want to mix it up here. Or if you're going to do what everyone seems to be doing, have a national primary. But the current system is neither fish nor fowl. And the other problem is, the earlier and earlier it gets, that means the longer and longer there is between when you have a nominee and when the general election is. And that's dead time. That's a very vulnerable position for any presidential candidate to be in.
And now I understand some of the candidates have actually banded together and promised they're not going to go campaign in states like Florida
yeah.
that are kind of trying to move their primary up or their caucus up. But can they really stay away from a place like Florida? Is somebody going to, like, sneak down to Boca Raton and throw out a few speeches?
There may be other reasons, personal, whatever, that they'll go down. But this is a very gray legal area. The national parties think that they have Supreme Court rulings to back them up here. But you could easily see yet another contested election where the party says, hey, listen, Florida, your delegates don't go to the convention. Florida says, well, you're disenfranchising all the voters here. And you could spend the 6 months or so between February and August watching legal battles being fought.
Oh,
you know,
goodness.
It wasn't that long since the last contested election.
Florida in the midst of a contested election. I can't imagine it. Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, thank you so very much.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
Allie, we've got the ramble coming up.
News we're not sure you can use, but we bet you'll like it. This is the Bryant Park Project.
Yes, it is.
From NPR News.
Yes, it is.
You know, this makes me want egg whites on rye, no butter, with a side of Canadian bacon.
Tom's Diner.
My favorite diner meal. Hey, you're listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. Coming up, we'll talk cubicle culture with The Wall Street Journal's Jared Sandberg. Right now, though, it's time for a little something we like to call the ramble. Wisconsin man woke up in a neighbor's yard without his pants and then remembered he'd left $41,000 worth of check in those pants. The guy's name is Mark Stonkey. He said he doesn't know what happened between when he left the bar and when he woke up the next morning. Sans pants, sans $41,000 check. But thankfully, a good Samaritan found the pants in an intersection. Where else would you leave them?
But you know when you're driving down the street and you just see like a pair of pants on the road and you wonder, what happened there?
Right, what's the story behind that? And you rarely think there's going to be a $41,000 check in it.
Why are those pants in the road? Anyway, the mayor of a Siberian oil town called Mijian has banned bureaucrats from using the phrases, I don't know and I can't. Also banned, it's not my job. The move is meant to cut through bureaucracy, improve discipline. A statement by the mayor said, I don't know is the same as admitting your helplessness. He banned 25 other phrases as a way to make his office, his administration, more efficient. He has banned, what can we do? It's not my job. It's impossible. I'm having lunch. There's no money. And I was away sick or on vacation.
How awesome would it be to bring that little, laminate it, and take that into the DMV next time you're there?
So good. So good.
Officials at Nepal's state-run airline sacrificed two goats this week to appease the Hindu sky god after technical problems occurred with one of its 757 aircraft. The goats were slaughtered at Nepal's only international airport in Kathmandu in accordance with Hindu traditions.
In Hair News today, a former CIA operative and Cuban exile named Gustavo Villoldo is auctioning off what he says is a lock of Che Guevara's hair. The hair is 40 years old, from 1967. Villoldo was involved in Guevara's capture in the jungles of Bolivia. According to unclassified U.S. records and some other documents, experts aren't sure how much the hair will raise. Bum-bum-ching at auction.
In other hair updates from the Bryant Park Hair Desk, Topps Bazooka Bubblegum has inserted 3 George Washington relic cards, complete with a strand of the Founding Father's hair, into prize packs of their baseball trading cards. Topps obtained the strands
from the world's...
I know. Like, the last thing you want... Remember when you get a piece of hair in your bubblegum? You're chewing. They're like... already doing that.
Why is that a good idea?
Topps got the strands from the world's preeminent historical hair collector. Yikes. John Reznikoff. eBay bids are already showing up on eBay for the cards, topping $8,000. So imagine this for a moment. It's the Sunday before Labor Day. You're a reporter, kicking back, maybe getting into your second gin. And then you get a call from the White House press office instructing you to be at Andrews Air Force Base that night. And that's all they tell you. You get there, you file onto Air Force One. You're still in the dark about what you're doing. And it isn't until you're in the air that they tell you you're on your way to Iraq, where the president is going to make a surprise visit. Well, this is exactly what happened this week. We actually did a little digging, and we found out that this is a pretty standard procedure when U.S. officials go to places like Iraq, when they're kind of keeping it on the down low. And Julian Barnes of the L.A. Times actually was on this super double secret trip. He made the trip with Defense Secretary Robert Gates, and he joins us now. Hi, Julian.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So what were you doing exactly when you got this call?
I was getting ready for a little Labor Day party with some friends, and I got a little email from one of the spokesmen at the Pentagon, and I thought for sure he was calling to complain about his story or something.
So you were like, did you have like a drink in hand, or were you like starting to scrape down the barbecue?
In fact, I was scraping down the barbecue. I did not have the drink in hand. I was going to go get the beer a little bit later in the day.
Did you have a hunch that this was somehow it was going to involve you going to Iraq?
Well, for the Pentagon reporters, we were told we were going to Iraq with Gates. What was unusual was, Secretary Gates is usually pretty public about when he goes to Iraq. And this time they said, you can tell your spouse and you can tell one person at your news organization, but don't dare tell anyone else.
Wow. But I'm really surprised that actually it didn't get out then, because... you know, this was a big story, that there was this secret trip. I mean, as it turned out, I'm amazed that there wasn't a leak. I guess, props to your wife.
She did tell my mother-in-law, but, we stopped it there.
Busted.
it turns out, actually, that there were a couple people at the L.A. Times who didn't know about the trip, but who guessed it. And they had told several people at the paper that they suspected that Bush would be going to Iraq on Labor Day. But unfortunately, none of those people told me of their suspicions. So I thought, until I got on the plane, that I was just going with Secretary Gates.
Julian, can you ever say no? You know, I'm really not feeling a war zone this weekend. Perhaps, on a serious note, maybe somebody's got a family, got a wife who's pregnant, something like that, and just decides, you know what, this is not the best time for me to be heading into a war zone. Or is that considered just bad form professionally?
Well, my wife is pregnant, and she definitely did not want me to say yes to going. But I think in this kind of situation, if you're covering the White House or if you're covering the Pentagon, and the president or the secretary tells you to go, you kind of need to go. But the other thing that you can tell people is, hey, listen, there are many, I've gone to Iraq many times before. I've done things that are probably relatively dangerous, like driving around with the troops in the streets of Baghdad. But when you go to Iraq with the President of the United States or with the Secretary of Defense, there's probably no better protected people in the world than those people. They take every security precaution that you could think of.
I've been on Capitol Hill a fair amount, and I know, reporters who cover the Pentagon or who cover the president or Congress, they sort of pride themselves in being over it all and kind of dispassionate, and, it's a competition mm-hmm. to sort of see who could who's the least impressed with the whole event. But when you get on, did you fly on Air Force One, Julian?
No, I flew on the secretary's plane, which instead of the sort of doomsday plane, which is a little fancier and more comfortable, they took a more tactical C-17. So it's sort of like hard chairs, steel floor, not very comfortable.
But
although the president did take Air Force One, which is much more comfy plane.
Well, when you get on the C-17 and you're looking around at these other guys and gals who cover this stuff regularly, but you know you're going to Iraq with the president, is everyone kind of excited? Or, you know, is it like you're going to the world's scariest summer camp?
There is a great deal of excitement on Secretary Gates's plane. They wouldn't tell us that the president was going to be there, but one of the reporters who has to remain nameless had sort of figured it out. And he told the rest of us.
It's like a game of telephone. The president's going to Iraq. The president's going to Iraq.
And so some of us, when we were writing our advanced stories, some people just wrote one story for Gates, and some people wrote two stories, one for Gates and one for Bush.
Right, because the White House – now, a lot of the people who cover the president were actually already on their way to Australia when it was announced that the president was going to actually make a stop in Iraq. Knowing what I know about reporters, those people must have been PO'd.
They were. Our White House reporter was in Honolulu refueling, which is not a bad place to refuel, but she had pool duty on Air Force One on the way back rather than the way there. So I think she was a little bit miffed that she was not on the more exciting leg of Air Force One.
Well, Julian Barnes of the LA Times, we're glad you made it back in one piece. And, you know, I guess the lesson for you is always be on your toes, even if it's a Sunday.
That's right.
All right. Thanks a lot. That's Julian Barnes of the LA Times talking about his top secret mission heading over to Iraq with Defense Secretary Robert Gates. Speaking of people, now that's a segue for you.
Where are we going?
Who have recently been in Iraq and are now back.
I see where we're
going.
And have
double top secret clearance and are from Idaho. Wait, that was actually, he wasn't from Idaho, Julian Barnes. Rachel Martin is here with some news updates, news headlines.
Hello.
Updates of the news headlines.
I am. And we will talk about those right now. Senator Larry Craig of Idaho is having second thoughts about stepping down from office. The 27-year Senate veteran announced his resignation last week after word got out of his arrest this summer in connection to a sex sting operation in Minnesota. Now, a spokesman for Craig says he may still fight for his seat if the lawmaker can clear his name with a Minnesota court and a Senate ethics panel. On August 1st, Craig pled guilty to a reduced charge of misdemeanor disorderly conduct after his June arrest at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. One of Senator Larry Craig's lawyers said today the Senate has no business looking into the conduct of one of its own. Following Craig's guilty plea, attorney Stan Brand says there's an unbroken line of precedence dating back more than 200 years that makes clear the Senate does not consider misdemeanor private conduct to be a fit subject of inquiry, and he wants the Senate ethics panel to dismiss its investigation. Authorities in Germany say three suspects arrested in a terror plot against an American airbase had enough explosive ingredients to make some large-scale bombs. The two Germans and a Turk are appearing today in court on charges of planning imminent attacks on Ramstein airbase used by U.S. and NATO forces and on Frankfurt's international airport. And rescuers are still combing the Nevada desert looking for millionaire adventurer Steve Fawcett. Fawcett was known for his frequent brushes with death as he set records for flying, sailing, and other pursuits. But on Monday, his small single-engine plane went missing after he set out on a trip across the Nevada desert. He was on a scouting mission trying to find the perfect smooth, dry lake beds where he hoped to try to make a new automobile speed record. Those are the headlines. I'm Rachel Martin.
Thank you, Rachel.
A 43-year-old Ohio woman spent her summer in a Kentucky jail. The government considers her a fugitive alien who should be deported to Liberia, even though she's married to a U.S. citizen, received a Social Security card, and has lived here for 24 years. So what changed? Well, first, the law a little bit. As a part of the Patriot Act, the National Fugitive Operations Program was established, which works solely on locating, apprehending, and removing people who stayed here beyond their welcome. Ironically, in this case, however, immigration did not have to find Bernice Bryant. She found them. Bernice and her husband, Sonny, who own and operate a driving school in Columbus, Ohio, are joining us on the phone now. So, Bernice, how long were you in jail and what was it like?
I stayed there for about 3 months. And being there wasn't fun at all. There were a lot of days that I had to just cry and cry.
I can imagine it was very lonely, wasn't it?
Very lonely. I mean, there's nobody there that I knew from anywhere. But I just tried to get friendly with the girls so that, you know, we all can get along and, you know, just go on with the day until things get better.
So how long have you been out of jail now?
I've been out for, I think, about 3 weeks now. This week will make me in the third week.
All right. Sonny, what was it like to see your wife in jail?
Well, it was horrible and heartbreaking because I was surprised to see the treatment we got from being honest with immigration. Pretty much that's what got me real shocked and surprised.
So, Bernice, explain to us how it is that immigration came to arrest you. What happened?
I still trying to think of what happened because what I was thinking on when I got arrested was that the only thing I could think of was the deportation things that happened in 1985. And because then they had given me every, permit that I, applied for, it kind of convinced me that, maybe, it's okay now. And everything is okay. So when they sent me a letter to say you need to come for your interview, I was very happy. But at the same time, I was kind of nervous. But when I got there, they're like, okay, we're holding you because of what happened in 1985.
So in 1985, the laws, as the immigration folks say, you were issued a deportation order in 1985, and you didn't leave the country. Is that true?
I couldn't leave because my children's father wrote to them to let them know that there was a war going on in Liberia and they were killing everybody that was part of that government, and he was part of that government also. So those were some of the things that made me to say, let me apply for political asylum so that I can stay here until everything is, quiet down or everything, go away. But this war lasted, as we know, it lasted for about 14 and a half years. So that was just half of the time that you cannot be brave enough to even think about going there. And I don't know anybody anywhere else other than here, which I have my husband here and my children. So I couldn't just leave the country. I mean, being here, knowing everybody else and my husband, I could not just leave to go anywhere because they wanted me out of here.
Sonny, are you an American? You're a U.S. citizen, is that correct?
That's correct.
All right, and your wife had gone to immigration because she wanted to be able to visit family in Liberia? That's how she got back on their radar?
That's correct.
All right.
Hey, Bernice, I was just sort of wondering, it seems like up to this point you really were kind of living out the American dream. You know, you moved here, you and your husband had a business, this driving school. Has this changed now, your experience of finding yourself in jail? Has this changed kind of your perception of the American dream and of life in the United States?
A little bit. It just, the part about it, I mean, going to jail, if that had, the feel that it was a punishment that I needed to go through, in order for them to, do what they have to do, okay, I understand that part, but doing it, surprisingly to me, because I applied for everything and they were willing to give it to me, then they never told me, you are wanted or, just something, just say something to me that I would know that, but now they've got it in the newspaper that I'm a fugitive. How you call that, fugitive? And, I've been right here. We bought a home. We've been there for over 8 years. And every permit that I apply for, I get it through that same address.
You must really feel like you really played by the rules here and find yourself in jail.
Yeah, I mean, to me, like I say, when I started getting, when I go to them for whatever I apply for, it made me feel comfortable. I kind of a little bit feel comfortable that everything is okay. But now they send me the letter, come and get your interview for your green card. That makes me happy to say, well, finally, maybe things are better now, and I'll go and get my green card. Because, I mean, if you look at, we got every document that say we went there every time and we applied for stuff and they were willing to give it to us, but they never warned me, say anything that we still you know, going to hold you responsible for not going where we told you to go.
Sonny,
until that day, that's what kind of surprising to me.
Sure. Sonny, let me read you a statement from the government, their response to your case, and then I'll get your response. The government says, our job in Immigration and Customs is to enforce, to carry out the judge's order. In this case, we're responsible for removing this person, meaning your wife, from the United States. How do you respond to that, Sonny?
Well, we have respected and obeyed every single law that what probably every normal citizen is supposed to obey. So when this deportation stuff came out, we have hired over 4 lawyers over the period, and you know, in excess of almost $18,000 to $20,000 in lawyers' fees, and nothing was accomplished. So if we have tried our best to resolve, you know, the deportation status, and immigration never give us any clue as to denying any access or privileges in America, we felt that we were okay. As far as I know, one of the lawyers told us that my wife was protected on my citizenship rights. That was one of the things they told us. And then number two, we filed I-90 for her, which they accepted. Immigration accepted the I-90. I filed for her, protecting her from being removed from the country.
So she was in the system. So you guys thought everything was okay, that she was already in the system, that she'd received the Social Security card, and therefore you would just carry on with your lives.
That's correct. We've been in the system every single time since I met Bernice.
Yeah.
I mean, and we've been together for 11 years now.
Hey, Sonny, yeah. What would the effect be on your life if Bernice ends up getting taken back to Liberia? Are you going to move back to Liberia? Will you stay in Ohio?
Well, inevitably, yeah, because I cannot have my wife staying somewhere where she absolutely know nobody there. As far as I'm concerned, I can't stay here because the business that we run, me and my wife run this business. So if she leaves, that'll be 50% of the effort that keeps this wheel turning. So I mean, the 3 months she was gone, the business went to a little slump. So can you imagine being gone? Because returning as by immigration law is 5 years. That's a long time.
That is a long time. Quickly, Sonny, before we let you and Bernice go, what's your next legal step?
Well, right now, our lawyer filed extension to reopen the case, and we are waiting for a response. The first response that was given was the lawyer told us that he's going to refile again for motion to reopen the case on status of the of now having Bernice to stay until she can get her papers together. That's where we are. And the next thing we are doing, the lawyer and I are trying to go to our congressman and his senator. He is making arrangements. So far, we are trying to do everything to get an attention to either pardon my wife, because they separate us. I mean, I don't know exactly what's going to happen to our family.
Sure, your whole family. Well, please keep us informed of what happened for you and to your family.
I sure will. I think we got contacted through our lawyer, Martin Medium.
We can do that. Bernice and Sonny Bryant, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you very much.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. This is the Bryant Park Project.
Yee-haw!
From NPR News. I don't know if my mic was on there, but that's probably for the better. I'd say about 50% of the time when I'm hosting, it's better to keep my mic off. I'm Luke Burbank. Coming up, we are going to have a new music preview with Andy Langer.
All right, giddy up, little doggy over there. I'm Allison Stewart. You know, sometimes the BPP staff, one of us sees a story in some other news outlet that we just can't resist. So we thought up a feature called Ripped Off from the Headlines. Stories we wish we thought of, but someone else did first. We go to a friend of our show, Jared Sandberg, and his article called The Art of Playing Dumb to Deter Unwanted Tasks, or as he eloquently put it, strategic incompetence. So if you're physically back at work this week, but in your mind, body, and spirit still on the beach somewhere with a cooler full of Red Stripe, this might be the story for you today. Jared Sandberg from the Wall Street Journal joins us now. Hi, Jared.
Hi, folks.
So you've observed in offices that declaring your non-skill can be a fantastic ploy for having the kind of work day that you really want. Can you give me an example of a non-skill that would make somebody's life better?
Well, let me give an example of Stephen Crawley, who was an HR executive, which he would consider the dumping grounds for all unwanted office tasks. Stephen was asked to organize a company picnic. He's a very dry guy, not the most bubbly type, didn't really want to organize a company picnic, and so his entire strategy was to basically ask a lot of questions. Well, how do you do that? What did you guys do in the past? Help me remember why we're talking about this picnic. And ultimately, responsibility for the picnic was reassigned.
What's fried chicken?
Right. Right. So mission unaccomplished. You know, he basically said, they said, you can't do this. You're incapable of organizing this picnic. And he got out of doing it.
Part of this, a little, though, is about power shifts. Tell us how a little strategic incompetence can really be a helpful and useful tool for an underling, for example.
Well, for a manager, we know that you can pretend to be incapable of lowly tasks. And so, you know, how do I make this copy? But for someone who's lower on the totem pole, it's really important. And as I mentioned in the column, it's attaining power through powerlessness. And that is that if you can't, if you claim that you don't know how to do something, then you can successfully dodge doing it. You know, you're not, it's not the most efficient use of your time or company money. And so it's a way oftentimes for people who don't want to do something because it's a lousy thing, you know, whether it's, you know, running documents from one floor to the next or making copies or all the rest. If you screw this up, then you will not be asked to do these kinds of things in perpetuity. And that's, you know, conversely, that's also the danger of doing a bad job well, as you may be saddled with it forever.
I have to say, Jared, that in my own professional life, I've totally seen this. When I was in my first gig, I was the summer intern at a local public radio station in Seattle, and my job was supposed to be to listen to all the voicemails of the various reporters and hosts and transcribe them. But I did such a lousy job of it that eventually they let me do some reporting because it was like the voicemail was not getting transcribed.
Right.
It just wasn't. But you have to be in an office where there are enablers. I can think of some New York City offices, people will be like, you are so not getting away with that.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And, you know, when the enablers sometimes – see, I don't think that anyone who's the victim of having to do the task that someone else got out of – there's no wool being pulled over anyone's eyes, particularly if you're the victim of this. But there is an element, particularly if you're someone who's helping a senior executive, there is an element of power – in the sense that, you know, you might like saving a senior executive from the embarrassing moment at the fax machine, and at least you can prove that you are competent at something that they're pretending they're not competent at.
Somebody once gave me a piece of advice I think falls into this category. They said, as a lady, you should learn to type, but just not very well, because you'll end up being an assistant or a secretary if you aspire to something else. You mean you might want to be an assistant or a secretary, but if you decide you want to do something else, don't learn to type so well.
Well, when you're a parent, it it can be helpful not to be able to change diapers terribly well.
So this does translate into real life. You can take this out of the office.
I think it's actually born at home. Once, you know, young kids have to do math word problems and a Beowulf book report, forget it. You know, mom and dad are going to end up helping out with that because they will claim they can't do it. But I think it's really refined when you become a parent. And Luke, you may know about this, but, you know, if you sit there and raise, you not only claim that you can't do it, you then raise the specter of disaster of what will happen if you actually do, for example, do a wash. You know, maybe I will shrink your sweater if I do the wash. Or, you know, how do you put this diaper on without leaking? Yeah. You know what I mean? And so you play dumb so that you don't do this. Unfortunately, it doesn't really work terribly well at home.
I have to say, Jared, though, I have taken this to a whole new level, which is when my kid wants help with her homework, I say I don't know how to do it.
Right.
So I'm just like flipping the whole script. I'm making my kid do her own homework by my own incompetence.
Yeah, but in my case, though, Luke, I really don't know how to do it.
No, believe me, it's not an act. It ain't an act. It's that stuff, like eighth grade algebra, that is wicked complicated.
I'm not there. I'm on second grade math, and I honestly had no idea what spirograms are, and I'm mystified.
I feel another column coming on. Jared Sandberg from the Wall Street Journal. He writes the column Cubicle Culture. Thanks a lot for joining us, Jared.
Thank you, folks.
Hey, if you have a good example of strategic incompetence in your workplace or in your life, email us at bryantpark@npr.org or post it to the blog npr.org/bryantpark. Now let's check the headlines. Here's Rachel Martin.
Hello, everyone.
This is NPR.
The music.
Yeah, it's. I think that any news sounder that gets stepped on 140% of the time may need some retooling.
I'll get it one of these days. Here are the headlines, folks. The Government Accountability Office, that's the branch of the U.S. government that releases reports regarding the war in Iraq, released such a study showing a grim picture of the current war. But before the report was released, White House and Pentagon officials said it was too harsh and they pushed for last-minute changes. The GAO rejected several of the Pentagon's suggestions and concluded Iraq had failed to meet all but two of the 9 security goals and that only one of 8 political goals had been met. Toy giant Mattel has announced yet another recall. It's the company's 3rd recall of Chinese-made toys in little more than a month because of excessive amounts of lead paint. On August 1st, Mattel's Fisher-Price division said it was recalling 1.5 million toys featuring characters such as Dora the Explorer, Big Bird, and Elmo. The latest recall covers 675,000 Barbie accessories sold between October 2006 and August of this year, but it should be noted no actual Barbie dolls were included in the action. And the nation's largest microwave popcorn maker, ConAgra Foods, says it will change the recipe for its Orville Redenbacher and Act 2 brands over the next year to remove a flavoring chemical linked to a lung ailment in popcorn plant workers. The decision comes a day after a doctor at a leading lung research hospital said in a warning letter to federal regulators that consumers, not just factory workers, may be in danger from fumes from buttery flavoring in microwave popcorn. Who knew? It's weird. That's the headlines. I'm Rachel Martin.
I had a dream I could buy my way to heaven. When I awoke, I smit that on a necklace. I told God I'll be back in a second. Man, it's so hard not to act reckless. To whom much is given, much is tested. Get arrested, guess until he get the message.
That's Kanye West with Can't Tell Me Nothing. It's off his new album, Graduation. It comes out next week. 50 Cent also has a record coming out. Apparently there's beef between Messrs. Scent and West.
Oh, you write for the New York Times? They always say that. Yeah. Mr. Send, who will drop his release.
It's called honorifics or something?
Yeah.
Anyway, Andy Langer, music critic for Esquire magazine, where they don't make you use honorifics, is here to fill us in on this stuff, also other new music that's coming up. Hi, Andy. Hello.
Let's talk beef.
Are you trying to start beef with the Bryant Park Project? Because seriously, we will send an email.
Yeah, I know where you live.
And it will
Don't
be ugly. Hey, Andy, welcome to the show. So what's going on with Kanye and Fitty? Like, why can't they just hug it out?
Well, I mean, they're leading up to what we're calling Super Tuesday, I suppose. And Super Tuesday, 9/11, they'll be both releasing records. The idea of people going to a record shop and being excited about either record is good for the ailing music industry, at least. I mean, the idea that these two big records are coming out on the same day and people are going to have choices at record shops is a good thing. Now, to sort of up the hype some, you know, 50 Cent offered to quit music altogether if he gets outsold by Kanye. He has since sort of backed off that.
Yeah, considering how his movie did,
yeah,
I think he should probably hedge that bet.
Yeah, and just a year ago, you know, 50 Cent upped the ante even more by saying Kanye's riding his coattail, that there'd be no Kanye West if 50 hadn't done what 50 had done. And, you know, at this point, all bets are off. They're both on the cover of Rolling Stone. Both albums leaked earlier in the week. So they're both out there and available to folks that want to download them illegally. And that's usually good for the guy with the better record. And that seems to be Kanye.
Well, speaking of which, let's hear a track off of this new Kanye record, Graduation.
All right.
This is Stronger.
Right, let's get lost tonight. You could be my black Kate Moss tonight. Play secretary on the boss tonight. And you don't give a f- what they all say, right? Awesome, the Christian and Christian Dior.
Damn, I admit this is in a heavy rotation on my MP3 player. I'm wondering, Andy, though, is there this... Hello? That's
Allison,
a nice little beep.
What's with all the swearing?
I'm wondering if it's
this
sort
is
of
NPR.
An interesting sort of class rift going on between Kanye and 50 Cent. I mean, Kanye's one of his parents is a college professor, and he's, you know, always sporting the sort of Ralph Lauren, Tommy Hilfiger.
The
I
Louis
just got
Vuitton
back from
Don.
The yeah. You know, is that part of the fight? I mean, is that maybe good for rap music and hip hop music to have these two sort of people from different parts of the world?
Yeah, I think it is good, you know, the diversity there between what are two giants of the game is definitely good. I think that they each have their own appeal because of that. I mean, soccer moms are going to be more likely to walk into Walmart and Target and pick up the Kanye West record for their kid than they are the 50 Cent record. I mean, because, you know, 50's reputation is built upon being shot a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. And he's never really shook off or wanted to shake off that really dangerous image. And I think that when people are going on Tuesday to buy that record, it's going to be a pretty clear split between people who are interested in Kanye, interested in the way he's sort of pushing the boundaries of hip-hop, and interested in 50 Cent, which is a lot more of the same. And the same has been a pretty good formula for him, though.
Well, speaking of Curtis Jackson, a.k.a. 50 Cent, let's hear a little bit off of his new record.
I took quarter water, sold it in bottles for $2. The Coca-Cola came and bought it for beans. What the fuck? Have a baby by me, baby. Be a millionaire, I write the check before the baby comes. Who the fuck cares? I'm
oh, they both need their mouths washed out.
Right before the show, our producer, MJ Davis, came and said, we can only play about 15 seconds of the 50 Cent song. Otherwise, the bleeping machine is going to actually start smoking and catch on fire. What do you make of this 50 Cent record?
It is a lot more of the same. You know, it's a solid 50 Cent record. If you're looking for adventure, though, if you're looking for something that's going to expand your boundaries just a little bit, then the Kanye record is the stronger record.
Well, meanwhile, as these two guys duke it out, at least in words anyway, Kenny Chesney is going to release an album coming up next Tuesday called Just Who I Am, Poets and Pirates. And you think this album is going to outsell them both? And you think I'm going to die a death inside?
Well, the dying a death inside part is pretty much a given, because Chesney, I mean, look at that title. That title tells you what the record is.
Like, it makes you want to listen to Jimmy Buffett. Like, it's
oh, come now. Some people really like Kenny Chesney.
Oh, God.
They do.
So this is the Kenny Chesney record is going to be a big seller, you think?
Yeah, it could outsell them both, and the likelihood that it will is strong. I mean, you know, there is Kenny Chesney's last four records have debuted at number one. It beat the soundtrack when 50 and Kenny Chesney had a record the same day, although that was a soundtrack record for 50 Cent. When they came out on the same day a couple of years back, Chesney outsold them. There's a good chance, especially because look at where records are sold. Walmart, Target, Amazon, those big box retailers. Who's shopping at those places? Kenny Chesney fans.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well.
And, you know, Kenny Chesney could very well outsell them.
Somebody get Kenny Chesney to agree to retire if Kanye outsells. Okay, I digress, and Allison's giving me a look. On to Fats Domino and a tribute to him. There's a new record coming out called Going Home. It's got Norah Jones on it, Lucinda Williams, Ben Harper, even Robert Plant. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Oh, won't somebody help me? Somebody help me.
Okay, so nobody got up this morning thinking, I hope I hear Fats Domino vaguely reggae-infused as interpreted by Robert Plant. But that's what they're going to get. Have you listened to this this album, and is it any good?
Yeah, this is the best tribute record in 10 years.
Wow. Whoa.
Now, to Fats Domino or just to anyone?
Well, to anyone. Because,
wow.
Look, you know, tribute records, more often than not, really just tell you who had some extra free time in their schedule and could go into a studio. You know, the way they put together tribute records these days has nothing to do with who actually is paying honor or who's being tributed by these records. And this one is genuinely heartfelt. It's the right people. I mean, you look at this track listing. It's Tom Petty. It's B.B. King, Paul McCartney, Dr. John, Neil Young, Lucinda Williams, Los Lobos. And what's really cool is they put most of them with New Orleans bands. So you've got, you know, all the great brass bands. You've got one track with Lenny Kravitz where he's got the Rebirth brass band from New Orleans with all three of James Brown's horns players.
Wow. And the proceeds go to help New Orleans Public Schools.
Oh, wow.
They do.
Proceeds from this record.
And so it's a little late on the Katrina front. I mean, although clearly they still need the help. I mean, to capitalize on people's, you know, generosity towards Katrina may be a little late, but this thing should sell itself with the sheer number of A-list artists here and the fact that each of these tracks is something special. I mean, it's really the rare tribute record that comes together and gels around something important.
Andy, you now hear that's not karaoke from a bowling alley. That's actually Led Zeppelin. Speaking of Robert Plant, Led Zeppelin is getting back together?
If you believe the hype, they will be back together in November. There's no official announcement, and it could just be, and it should just be, a one-off, a one-hour show at the O2 Arena in London. It'll theoretically honor the late Atlantic Records founder Ahmet Erdogan, and that's been in the works for some time, a tribute to Ahmet Erdogan. The idea that Zeppelin would get together has been thrown around since back when Erdogan died. But what they're saying now is that it's looking very likely. Harvey Goldsmith, the promoter for Zeppelin, put out a statement last week warning people that a lot of the packages being sold for a full tour aren't the real thing, but he never said there was no show. Mm. So, and then this morning, the NME in the UK apparently heard from an autograph collector that stopped Robert Plant and asked him about the union. And Plant said, well, how did you hear about that? And then said, well, it's just a one-off.
Oh.
Now, whether you believe some autograph collector who called into NME is, you know, a question of how much you believe of the things you read on the internet.
Yeah.
But then again, this looks likely for a one-off. The money be ridiculous, and they could sell DVDs, CDs, you know, capture this 27-year in the making.
Andy, we all know that's what arena rock is not about. It's not about money. It's not about selling T-shirts. Oh, wait, that's exactly what it's about. Andy Langer, Esquire Magazine. Oh, thank you! try to segue from that, Allison.
There it is. I hope you're still listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
Are you ready for hour number two of the Bryant Park Project for NPR News? I am. I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. I'm like halfway through my box of Tic Tacs, so we're like, I'm pacing myself beautifully.
You are minty fresh, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. We have got a whole bushel full, or I guess technically like 58 minutes full of news and information for you coming up. We're going to talk about NBC getting into it with iTunes on the very day that a new iPod is being unveiled. An iPod that could be great news for the Bryant Park Project.
Oh, that's a good tease. We'll tell you why in just a little bit. Can you believe a month ago tomorrow is when those Utah miners were trapped at the Crandall Canyon Mine. It's a story that's been pushed off the front pages of the papers. As we have promised you since the beginning, we're going to follow up on news stories that may go by the wayside. We'll talk to a local reporter who's been on the story since the very beginning.
Yeah, we're also going to play a little game we call Where's Condi? The other day, on the cover of the New York Times, there was a specter, a ghost, if you will. It was actually Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who has been out of the spotlight for what seems like a long time. We're going to find out what she's been up to, if that's been a purposeful move, and where she might be going during the end of the president's term.
We'll have Rachel Martin with the news in just a moment, but we do want to get to one of today's big stories.
One of the stories that we are all talking about here this morning, adventurer and millionaire Steve Fawcett is missing. Now, you might remember him. He made news being the first person to fly around the world alone in a balloon. In 2005, he was the first person to fly a plane solo around the world without refueling.
He swam the English Channel in 1985, but his next goal was to break the world land speed record.
Now, in pursuit of that goal, he was scouting a dry lake bed or dry lake beds in Nevada this week, flying around in a single-engine plane on Monday. That's when he vanished. The area he was scouting was a sagebrush-filled desert surrounded by rugged mountains.
Crews from the Nevada Air National Guard, Civil Air Patrol, and Fallon Naval Air Station are searching that area today. The plane is a Blanca Citabria Super Decathlon. Now, there was a locator on the plane that sends a satellite signal after a rough landing, but there has been no such signal received. Major Cynthia Ryan with the Civil Air Patrol in Nevada says that Fawcett may not have been prepared for an emergency.
As I understand it, he planned to be gone such a short length of time that he did not take some of the emergency equipment with him that he would normally take.
Fawcett's longtime friend, entrepreneur Sir Richard Branson, told NBC's Today show this morning that he's sure his old friend could have survived.
As long as he's alive, he'll survive. I mean, he's the most resourceful man alive in the world today. He's really sort of superhuman. He's maybe only half human.
Nevada National Guard planes and helicopters in the rescue effort are using infrared and other high-tech vision equipment. The search continues throughout today. We'll bring you more on the story as it develops. Now here's a roundup of some of the day's other news with our very own Rachel Martin.
Hey, Lincoln. This is NPR.
Every time, the music. Hey, everyone, I'm Rachel Martin, and here's the news. The U.S. government has received some not-so-hot marks from its accountability office, the GAO. The GAO yesterday released a report giving some a grim picture of the war in Iraq. But before it was released, White House and Pentagon officials said it was too harsh and they pushed for last-minute changes. The GAO rejected several of these suggestions and concluded that Iraq had failed to meet all but two of the 9 security goals Congress set as benchmarks for improvement, and that only 1 of 8 political goals had been met. But the report was recrafted to show partial progress for 4 benchmarks, including the elimination of havens for militia forces and the deployment of Iraqi army brigades to help secure Baghdad. Military leaders in Baghdad say the report is flawed. They call it factually incorrect. The top general in Iraq, David Petraeus, and the U.S. ambassador in Baghdad, Ryan Crocker, are expected to give their progress report to Congress next week. Meanwhile, President Bush insisted today during a trip to Australia that there are signs of progress in Iraq. Bush is in Sydney for the annual Asian-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, or APEC, meeting. In a press conference with Australian Prime Minister John Howard, Bush staunchly defended the war and praised Australia for its military support in Iraq. That's something Prime Minister Howard has taken political heat for at home. Authorities in Germany say three suspects arrested in a terror plot against an American airbase had enough explosive ingredients to make some pretty massive bombs. The two Germans and a Turk are appearing today in court on charges of planning imminent attacks on Ramstein Air Base, that's the base used by U.S. and NATO forces, and on Frankfurt's International Airport. AP Berlin correspondent Dave McHugh says the group had enough explosives to do some serious damage.
They could have made a bomb with the explosive power of something like 550 kilograms of TNT, which is about 1,200 pounds, so a very large bomb.
A German federal prosecutor says the three had trained in Pakistan with a group called the Islamic Jihad Union, described as a Sunni Muslim organization based in Central Asia. And Senator Larry Craig of Idaho is having some second thoughts about stepping down from office. The 27-year Senate veteran announced his resignation last week after word got out of his arrest this summer in connection to a sex sting operation in Minnesota. But a spokesman for Craig says he may still fight for a seat if the lawmaker can clear his name with the Minnesota court and a Senate ethics panel. And just when you thought it might be safe to go into Toys R Us again, toy giant Mattel has announced yet another recall. It's the company's third recall of Chinese-made toys in little more than a month because of excessive amounts of lead paint. On August 1st, Mattel's Fisher-Price division said it was recalling 1.5 million toys featuring characters such as Dora the Explorer, Big Bird, and Elmo. The latest recall covers hundreds of thousands of Barbie accessories sold earlier this year. And that's the news. I'm Rachel Martin.
You know, you just can't trust a toy store when the R is backwards. How do they not notice that? It's on like millions of signs. Anyway. Scanning the cover of the New York Times yesterday, I saw a shadowy figure. I thought maybe it was Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster. Actually, it was the Secretary of State of the United States, Condoleezza Rice. She was walking with the president in Iraq. Now, recently with so much Alberto Gonzalez and Karl Rove in the news, it seems like it's been kind of easy to forget about her, and she's somebody who has been a really high-profile member of the president's cabinet. So we sort of wondered, what exactly has she been up to? We've got Marcus Mabry to join us. He's the author of Twice as Good, a biography of Condoleezza Rice. Hi, Marcus.
How are you?
Great. Thanks a lot for coming on the Bryant Park Project. Has Condoleezza Rice been trying to sort of distance herself from the president?
You know, I don't think so. I certainly understand why you asked the question, because as you said, this is once the most high-profile, visible member of in the first term of George Bush's presidency, of his White House staff, and then in the second term, of course, of his cabinet as Secretary of State. So it's a question I do understand where it comes from, because Rice has disappeared in many ways, certainly relative to her past presence, from public view. But, you know, I don't think it's about distancing herself from the president. Firstly, I would say that they have a pretty extraordinary historical bond, you know, looking back over the bond between presidents and secretaries of state. They are closer than almost anyone, and certainly all presidents and secretaries of state in recent history. He sees her as his sister, and she does see him as her brother. So I don't think she would actually distance herself. What we are seeing, I think, is that she has put all of her energy into trying to salvage from what, in many ways, I think you have to judge so far as a foreign policy disaster of George W. Bush's tenure. She's trying to salvage what she can of the next 18 months they have. So I think she's working pretty furiously in private on trying to get some deals between, in particular, Israelis and the Palestinians, and make some progress on trying to curtail Iran's nuclear ambitions without going to war, which is what some folks like Vice President Dick Cheney and his camp would be proposing in the White House. So I think
Do you think that she would be more helpful to the president if she was doing what it says what she is doing, in your opinion, which is sort of working behind the scenes? Or would she be more helpful by actually just posing in a lot of photos with the president? Because she does seem to be one of the few members of the cabinet who actually has high approval ratings. People seem to like her.
Well, certainly, you know, relative to the rest of the administration, she does have high approval ratings. She's barely in negative territory, and that is a recent occurrence.
That's a big victory in this administration, I guess, right?
Exactly,
now.
Exactly, huh? Exactly. You know, look at these guys are – it looks like the last days of Pompeii down there. You know, the loyalists are leaving, and the people who stay look incompetent or ineffectual. There's no way denying that this administration is incredibly hard put right now to justify, you know, its existence. So in the next 18 months, the most important thing is to try to salvage something of a legacy for this president. And I think Rice cares a great deal about him personally, more actually than her own reputation, actually. And as, you know, a lot of people told me in the book, her stepmom and her closest friends, they think that she's actually too loyal to George Bush and too worried about his legacy, and that her own in the process is going to be tarnished historically.
Marcus, in terms of the business of Washington, D.C., a lot of it gets done. We never see it. It's the parties, it's the meetings, it's the lunches. Is Condoleezza Rice actually in D.C. doing that backroom work, or is she abroad doing her work in other countries and talking to other world leaders?
She certainly spends a lot more time abroad, and historically speaking, she's one of the most traveled secretaries of state in American history. She spends a lot more time abroad than she does in those Washington kind of, you know, behind-the-scenes events. She's not very good. She doesn't like the whole Washington kind of social scene where you kind of puff yourself up and emphasize your own importance as a player inside the Beltway by going out to these different social events and glad-handing. But you also, as you said, Allison, you also establish alliances and relationships that way. She's very good at alliances and relationships, one-on-one, up on the Hill, in meetings with senators and congresspeople from both parties. She's not good, however, at that kind of behind-the-scenes stuff that happens in the social circuit, you know, after dark in Washington. She likes to go to bed early and get up early to work out. So that's, she's all business and somewhat, I think, a lot less glad-handing than most of Washington. So I think she would concentrate a lot more, and she does concentrate a lot more on those serious matters, like, again, trying to salvage a somewhat of a positive legacy from this administration. And she still believes that the war in Iraq may turn out to be such a legacy, but she also acknowledges that, you know, the chances are about 50-50 at this point.
If she was doing a performance review with the president or maybe vice president, I don't know who actually conducts those, but what would be some of the things she could point to in terms of this kind of on the margins of diplomacy stuff you're talking about? Like, what kind of, you know, relationships has she forged? What has she done well over the last year?
Well, she has done a good job, actually, of getting the Israelis and the Palestinians to actually sit down and talk, at least. She is very close to the Israeli foreign minister, her counterpart, Livni over there, who actually is another woman who is very like-minded with Rice, very kind of a tough woman who also is kind of no-nonsense. She also, of course, can look back. I think the most successful thing that she's done in her tenure so far as Secretary of State has been the North Korea deal. The fact that we actually, although that was criticized from both the left and the right, the fact that we actually got a deal in North Korea, she convinced this president to talk to them. She convinced this president to listen to Chris Hill, his envoy, who actually made progress with the North Koreans and got them to freeze their nuclear program and start dismantling. So that's huge progress. I think that's something she can be proud of. But again, the obstacles that remain, the challenges that remain, and namely that is Iran, that is a real peace in the Middle East, a real final settlement, which she concludes more or less at this point she probably will not get on her tenure, but if she can make as much progress with that as possible, she'd be happy with that. And then finally, of course, it's Iraq, and her ability to change the situation there is pretty limited, of course, but I think those are the three big obstacles that remain.
You know, there was a time when she was, I guess, like everyone at some point gets bandied about as a presidential candidate if they occupy a certain level.
Say
of
not me. I don't know who you're talking about.
Believe me. And once they hear this show, I'm never getting on that list. But there was a time when people talked about her as an 08 candidate, maybe.
Yeah.
Or she's gonna, when she's done being Secretary of State, she's gonna be like 54, pretty young. And what do you think she does next, Marcus?
She's going to be very young, and you know what her friends and family tell me is that they actually think she'll come back to Stanford, kind of rest and recuperate for a year. You know, she never wanted to be Secretary of State. She was planning to go back at the end of the first term, and she told me how George Bush asked her to stay after he was reelected, and how she had to think about it for the weekend, and she decided to stay because, as she said, she thought there was a lot more progress they could make in the agenda that they were trying to carry out, and she said that with a great deal of humility when we were talking. So that was somewhat surprising to me. I think what she'll want to do, and a lot of her friends say this as well, that she'll want to make a little bit of money. That what makes a Secretary of State, while it's certainly a not a bad salary. It's not as much as one could make as, say, either a board member, as she was before she went into the White House as National Security Advisor in the first term, a corporate board member, or even a corporate executive working with a multinational or leading a multinational, where one can make real money and where one can actually run something. She likes, as she's said to me, she likes to run stuff a lot more than she likes to be managed, and then she likes to manage other people. She likes to run an organization. That's what she did at Stanford as provost. It's what she's done at the State Department, as opposed to what she did as National Security Advisor when she didn't really run anything but had to cajole other people to do what she wanted. She's not so great at that. She's much better at running something, and that's what I think she'd like to do, and maybe make a little bit of money in the process.
Who doesn't love that cheddar? Marcus?
I would not rule out politics, however, though. As Charlie Black told me, a Republican strategist, one of the great Republican gurus for that party, he suspects that for the rest of her life, because she's a black woman, she will be looked upon as, if not the top of a Republican ticket, as a possible vice presidential candidate for whoever runs for the Republican presidential nomination now or going forward.
Marcus Mayberry is the author of Twice as Good, a biography of Condoleezza Rice. These days, he also serves as the international business editor over at the New York Times. Marcus, thanks a lot for coming on the Bryant Park Project.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marcus. Hey, coming up on the BPP, we're going to take a look at some of the most viewed and most emailed articles from the New York Times, for example, regarding something in camping. I'm not really sure. We'll find out.
Also, we're going to talk to a reporter who wrote a really interesting first-person kind of article, kind of essay about following her deceased mother's kind of eBay record and what she learned about her mom through this. You're going to want to stick around for this. That's coming up on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Coming up, an edition of Make Me Care. Someone's going to attempt to make us give a hoot about the Pan-Asian Summit, the APEC Summit. But right now, we're going to
get our loyal producers, MJ Davis and Dan Pashman, to come on into the studio here. This is always the part of the show that's a little dangerous because Dan also directs.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like having the guy driving the car climb to the back of the Ford Econoline van.
Yep. Our segment is called The Most, and we ask everybody on staff to take a look at the most emailed or the most viewed at various websites and magazines and bring in their favorite most post, so to speak. So, MJ, what do you like today?
Ooh, I like the New York Times.
Hold on, MJ. We got to get your... microphone.
Oh, you got to move over
on.
To the other
yeah,
microphone.
You got to head over here, I guess.
Okay, now I'm on this mic. Everybody hear me?
I still don't actually hear you on the mic. Give it a shot now.
Can you hear me now?
Nope.
Can you hear me now?
Nope. Just keep doing it. This
can
is good.
Can you hear me now?
Okay. Keep going.
No? Oh, should I go with mine while they work that out?
You know, MJ, come over here to my mic. Let's get cozy.
I'm going to snuggle up to Luke real nice.
That's
and close.
Right.
Oh, you've got
that's
Tic Tacs
right. I know.
Here.
I told you. I tried to keep it nice. Okay, so what did you see? What's your most story?
My most story is called No More Privies, So Hikers Add a Carry-On. Can you guess what the carry-on is?
No.
It's their pee.
Oh, wait. So what are they actually doing? They're trying to – they're packing their pee out? Or no,
they're packing their pee out. So the
– Oh, carry-in, carry-out. It's a hiker rule.
Yeah, yeah.
But your pee?
Everything. Well. Formerly the highest outhouse in continental United States was Mount Whitney, California. And the park system all the way through Mount Rainier and then down into Zion National Park in Utah – has decided that they can't deal with outhouses anymore. They were helicoptering in hazmat workers and then tying 250-pound bags of pee and poop to the helicopter ropes and then helicoptering them out. It was a big ordeal.
Wait,
and now,
where did you get this story from?
New York Times.
Okay.
I swear, it's legit. I'm not lying.
I love that. Where did you get this from?
Yeah. The best part of this is the bags that they give you to carry your, like...
refuse.
I mean, I guess, who's going to catch you if you don't take your pee out? But your refuse. They look like a double-sealed Ziploc.
Yeah, you better hope that's double-sealed.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. And they're saying, like, they're still going to helicopter in for rescue missions, just not to carry out your bathroom stuff.
Okay. All right, so that's from the New York Times, the most emailed story.
Exactly.
Dan Pashman here.
I actually, you can
there
tell.
There you go.
Yeah, look at that. You can tell that MJ and I didn't compare notes because I also took my most story from the NewYorkTimes.com. I hope that, I don't know, does that violate the rules of the most? What's the protocol?
We prefer
here?
It not next time, but we'll let it slide, Cashman.
Right. I'll take a lap.
Allison is the official, as the person who owns the trademark on the most, she is the ultimate rules person. She says it's okay.
Okay, thank you. Well, this one is actually from the sports section, but it's kind of a human interest story. Alex Rodriguez, who you guys may know, A-Rod, he's a famous mm-hmm. baseball player on the New York Yankees. Mm-hmm. Turns out he has a half-brother who is a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. Hmm. And they have been apart. They have not seen each other for 23 years and were just recently reunited. They share a father in common. And it's just kind of an interesting story because I'm generally kind of fascinated with A-Rod. He's sort of this... a tragic hero figure who is blessed with these amazing baseball abilities but kind of doesn't quite seem happy, doesn't quite seem right. Like there's a little something not
a little
quite...
little robotic. Yeah.
Exactly.
I had an A-Rod sighting. I ate dinner 10 feet from him.
Oh, wow.
Yes. He's very handsome.
Yeah. I actually interviewed him in Seattle.
Oh, fine.
Times.
One up me. Fine.
No.
Go ahead, Dan.
Listen. At
hand,
the Old Country
hand.
Buffet.
Dan is talking.
No, I'm just saying...
You interviewed A-Rod in Old Country Buffet.
No, I just said that to try to be funny. No, Allie, though, let me say this. Your impression is right. Your impression
was
right.
The back of my chair is to you. What does this say to you? This means I'm not speaking. Dan, continue.
Oh, snap. Don't go on a tic-tac binge just because you're upset, Luke.
Okay, sorry.
I just think it's a very interesting story. The part of the story that I found most interesting was the similarity that the writer, Jack Curry, who has interviewed A-Rod and also interviewed the brother, found between the two of them that is apparently traced back to their father, from whom they're both estranged.
Mm-hmm.
So they both had this tough relationship with this father who's this sort of very terse, very tight-lipped man, and they both have a rocky relationship with him, and they've kind of reunited in recent years. And it's kind of a pretty touching story, I felt.
I mean, you have to say, though, for guys who didn't grow up knowing, it sounds like anyway, their father having a real close relationship, they both turned out pretty okay. I mean, A-Rod, even if he's a little robotic, seems to be a pretty upstanding guy.
Right.
And his brother is just like in this really important
Except
position.
Except when he's in Toronto
well,
with the blonde.
Oh, yeah.
There's that.
Okay. Let's not go down that road.
All right, Danny, what do you got next? You got another most for us? I think MJ said that you
sure.
were going to pick up the slack.
Well, yeah, there's another most off NPR.org that a guy named Brian Unger, who we like, did. And it's sort of coming out of the whole Larry Craig scandal. And it's all about basically how do you break the news to your kids? You have these sort of sex scandals going on in the news. What are you going to do to explain to them about it? And we actually have a piece of that audio of Brian Unger's piece. Let's take a listen.
Today's headlines violate standards of family values and decency and push the boundaries of adult sensibilities. But what about the children? What do you say to a child who asks, "Mommy, Daddy, why is my senator trying to get down with a dude in an airport bathroom? Do I have a wide stance when I go potty? Why did my senator leave, Mommy?" Introducing the new DVD, How to Talk to Your Children About Republicans and Their Special Friends.
When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn?
Never before has there been a collection of songs, games, and dance routines covering the many, many kinds of special friends some
this
Republicans
one's been,
have.
This one's been
in
number
fun,
one
easy to understand
the
sections.
Past 3-4 days. It's worth the entire listening.
Yeah, it's way up there.
I have to say, by the way, I'm sure I know who produced that, a guy named Steve Proffitt in L.A. who's super good. He should get some props, too, for that. And that's Brian Unger. I think it was on Day to Day was the program.
That's correct.
NPR Most Emailed Story. Well, Dan Pashman, I see by the clock up there that your time here is done.
Dope.
Time to go back into the chaos that is the control room. Thank you, though, for sharing the most with
My
us.
My pleasure. Thanks
All right.
for having
thanks,
me.
MJ, as well. And our thanks to Brian Unger, too. 1 month ago tomorrow, this was the huge story of the day.
We have a crew on the way to Huntington Canyon, where we understand six miners are unaccounted for at the Genwal mine, where there was a collapse of some sort this morning.
There was an earthquake earlier this morning. It was a 4.0 magnitude. Now, they're not quite sure, officials aren't, whether that is what caused the collapse, but, you know, that would give you reason to believe it may have played a role. We'll, of course, sort that out throughout the day, and we'll have a live report, as you mentioned, at noon.
Now, back on August 6th, that's what we all thought happened. But, of course, now we have more details. It wasn't really an earthquake. The miners would not be found. It's a story that dominated, but it's been pushed off the front pages of the national papers by bathroom sex scandals and hurricanes named Felix. But let's make a little time for a Bryant Park Project follow-up on the Crandall Canyon miners with Christopher Smart from the Salt Lake Tribune. Hey, Chris.
Good morning.
So, for the record, now on September 5th, what is the status of the recovery operation, rescue and recovery?
Well, on August 31st, all operations ceased after officials for the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration determined that there was nothing left to be done. As you recall, on August 16th, three rescuers were killed when they tried to tunnel into the area where they believed the trapped miners might be found.
And that was a turning point in this whole story.
Yeah, it was a turning point. What it left rescuers with was the only option was to drill holes down into the mine from the mountaintop that was anywhere from 1,400 to 1,800 feet above. They sank seven such holes into various parts of the mine where they hoped to find those men. They did never find them.
Now, is the mine open in any capacity at this point?
No, it's completely closed down. However, federal officials began arriving yesterday to start an investigation, and that's going to be one of a handful of investigations into this tragedy.
And what ultimately will be the outcome of those investigations? Is it the change in mine safety laws? Is it...
Well, it's interesting because the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration, with the acronym MSHA, is investigating, but it's also the federal agency that signed off on the mining plan. And when Robert Murray bought the mine a little more than a year ago, he began changing the mine plan, and they sent they decided to do what's called retreat mining, where they pull out the barriers that keep the mine up. And so MSHA signed off on that. So now MSHA is going to investigate the accident as it normally does, but the Department of Labor has launched a second investigation into MSHA and how it handled, you know, was it too cozy?
Back in the day when it said they could go ahead and change the mining plan.
Right, which is back in the day was in November of last year and then again early in the spring of this year. So it's all very recent.
I'm wondering how much you know about sort of how the families are holding up. And, I mean, are they still going to the mine? And are there any of them that are still holding out any kind of hope? Or have they kind of made peace with the fact that these guys aren't coming out?
Yeah, this was a real story of just human drama where for 25 days these families kept holding out hope. They were in a state of limbo. Not knowing, you know, what to do, whether their loved ones were alive or dead. At this point, their loved ones are dead, and they recognize that. They still would like closure by getting the bodies out. The problem is, number one, they don't know where the bodies are. Number two, the mine is so unstable after this recent mining activity that it is impossible to go back in there, and into the foreseeable future, it is impossible to go back. So those men are entombed in the mountain there.
Christopher, is there any part of this story that you think was underreported, that maybe the national media didn't get, maybe something you saw or something you think is important that people know about the story and remember about this story?
Well, the first thing that happened on early in the morning of August 8th was a University of Utah seismologist called the Emory County Sheriff's Office, and he said, you know, we've recorded this activity, and it looks like it could be a mine disaster. So he called before the mine people even called the sheriff. That's number one. The second thing was that Mr. Murray kept insisting all along that his company did not change the mining strategy, but federal documents state otherwise. So what you're going to see in the coming year is that there's going to be a lot of fact-finding, and since these things take so long to play out, we may not know. The general public may not know what the outcome is. But
for a while, it sounds like.
Yeah, but hopefully the one thing that could come out of it is that miners would begin to have some sort of communication device so during these sorts of accidents, we at least would know where they are.
Christopher Smart from the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you so much for sharing your reporting.
Okay, thank you.
Now here's Rachel Martin with the news headlines.
This is NPR.
Hey, everyone. Authorities in Germany say three suspects arrested in a terror plot against an American airbase had enough explosive ingredients to wreak some serious havoc and damage. The two Germans and a Turk are appearing today in court on charges of planning attacks on Ramstein Air Base and Frankfurt's International Airport. Rescuers today are still combing the Nevada desert looking for millionaire adventurer Steve Fawcett. Monday, his small single-engine plane went missing after he set out on a trip across the desert. Fawcett was on a scouting mission to find the perfect place to try to make a new automobile speed record. And in sports, say you're one of the best college football teams in the country, and say you lose an important game to one of college football's serious underdogs. Is not the loss punishment enough? Nope. 3 days after Michigan's dramatic upset loss to Appalachian State, the one-time Big Ten conference favorites have been kicked out of the league's top 25. Those are the headlines. I'm Rachel Martin.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project. Thanks, Rachel. I'm Luke Burbank. You know, one of our producers, Ilya, forwarded me this article yesterday from the Wall Street Journal, which had one of the most kind of odd and gripping opening paragraphs I've ever read. I'll read it for you. On September 17th, 2003, in a chaotic intensive care ward, just before being medically induced into a coma, my mother summoned all of her energy and whatever oxygen she could to make one request: take care of my eBay. Katie Rossman wrote that article. She's here with us now to explain kind of what happened after that moment. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Your mom did end up passing away, unfortunately, but a couple of years later, you decided to kind of go back through all of her eBay dealings, which were pretty extensive. What did you find out?
Well, I started out by just wanting to learn about this glass collection that she had amassed in the last couple of years of her life. And in trying to figure out who I should be talking to learn about the actual pieces of glass, I started going through her email account, which my sister and I have saved, and her eBay account, which we also have saved. And I found that she was very much a part of a community, and that there was one gentleman in particular that she was confiding in about dying, sometimes in ways that she wasn't confiding in her family. And we were we are very close family, and we were intimately involved in the entire process of her illness.
So these were other eBayers, other people who were as involved with collecting glass as your mom was.
Right.
What do you think it was about? In the article, you mentioned that when things would sort of go badly, or where there would be a sad moment, your mom would grab her laptop and start looking at her glass on eBay. What do you think it was about this experience that was so kind of alluring to her?
Well, as it's been explained to me by her friend Carl, who I've subsequently met with a couple times, she told him that on eBay she felt normal. She wasn't defined by this disease of lung cancer. She wasn't limited by the disease. I think when you are very sick, it quickly takes over your persona. The first and only question is,
how do you feel?
What did the doctor say? How is chemo? How's your breathing? And anything outside of that just fades away. And for a person, and judging from the mail I've gotten, my mom was not alone in this, it can be a isolating and painful experience to lose any normal intercourse with the world and just have everything be about the one thing you don't want to talk about.
Mm-hmm. What was her eBay online ID?
Susie Rosen.
So she was straight up who she was.
She was straight up who she was. Her
no secret life. She wasn't pretending to be
Wheeler dealer 2005.
No, and I didn't find anything shocking or illicit in going through her emails. Though I did find, as you alluded to, I found that she, you know, right before a surgery, she picked a fight with this woman. Somebody had sold her a piece, and my mom had decided it was a fake. And really just ripped into this woman. They had this extensive back and forth. I took photos of the entire collection and asked somebody at the Corning Museum of Glass to consult with me. Unprompted, the curator pointed out that glass and said, I think that's the most valuable piece of your
mom's.
Oh, no.
Which... just made me really, really laugh. And I like to think my mom had enough of a sense of humor that she would have laughed about it, too.
You wrote about meeting up with this guy, Carl Bellavia in New
Bellavia.
York. Bellavia. Mm-hmm. Who was kind of your, like, a guy who knew a lot about glass and so would
kind
of consult your mom on, you know, this is valuable and this. And they really had forged a relationship. He even went to church and lit candles for her.
He did, which I only found out subsequently in meeting him at the end of the summer. And this was a guy who lives in Jersey City. My mom was in Tucson, Arizona. They never met. They spoke on the phone once, but they emailed back and forth several times a day, about six days a week, if not every day. And they were really close. And a lot of the conversations were about glass. I think most of the conversations were about glass. But in the end, he provided for her a coping mechanism by talking to her about the glass, and in the end was a really important person in her dying process.
I want to get back to something you said earlier. You talked about how eBay was a place where your mom wasn't sick Susie. She was just Susie the glass trader, and she protected that. There was an opportunity for her to get some money back if she perhaps had told someone she was sick.
Well, there was one incident where she accidentally bought a table, this big, huge, heavy, not pretty
not glass
table.
Yeah,
that nothing glass or elegant about this table. And she instantly told me and my sister when she was billed for it that the dealer had made a mistake, that there's something wrong with the computer machinery. She hadn't entered this bid. She doesn't know what they're talking about. She called the guy every name in the book. and then slowly she began to admit that maybe the oxycodone she was taking, because by now the cancer was through her bones, which is very painful, had caused her to place an errant bid. And my sister and I encouraged her, you know, go to eBay administration and tell them this. Tell them that you're taking pain medicine for cancer. Tell the dealer. And she refused. And she told us at the time that eBay had a policy that if you basically were drunk bidding or bidding under the influence, that they would rescind your privileges. Subsequently, I called eBay and they said that that is not, in fact, the case, that they have all sorts of mediation policies in place. But my mom really, even though it would have been to her benefit to explain the situation, just refused to let cancer enter that part of her world.
Hey, Katie, I didn't actually ask the control room if we can do this, but we're going to be up against a break here. Can you stick around to the next segment?
Sure.
Okay, great. So this is the Bryant Park Project. We're talking to Katie Rossman, reporter with the Wall Street Journal, about her mom's sort of really extensive eBay life, which, as her mom has passed away, has become kind of a testament to her. We're going to talk about that, NBC versus iTunes, and lots of other stuff coming up.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project. I'm Allison Stewart, along with Luke Burbank. Coming up, an edition of Make Me Care. Of course, we all care that the president went to Iraq. Do we care that he's at the Pacific Asian Economic Summit?
Not yet.
Someone will try to make us care. Stick around for that.
First, though, we're kind of finishing up a conversation we started in the last part of the show with a woman named Katie Rossman. She's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She wrote this great piece about her mother who passed away from cancer and about going back into kind of her mother's life on eBay, which involved buying lots of glass. She was sort of a collector, and this became kind of a refuge for her. And you even went and met some of these people that she had sort of become friends with. And
I did.
And I guess I was kind of wondering, you know, she talked about – she was sort of terrified of having her having negative feedback.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a woman who's very sick with cancer, and it seems like she's almost more worried about negative feedback on her eBay account.
Well, as you pointed to in the beginning of the story, she literally was about to be medically induced into a coma from which we all were told she may never wake. And her parting words were, take care of my eBay. She really was concerned about her reputation. And it was apparently a lifeline for her. It was a source of frustration for my sister and I that sometimes when we tried to have a sentimental conversation or bring out a photo album, she just would hear none of it and would instantly retreat into the computer. But 2 years after my mom died, we understand it more and I think are glad that she found some of what she needed.
Have you left her account up? Does it still exist on eBay?
It still
exists.
But we changed her password because we put her password in this story.
Right.
That's right. It's a meditation term.
Yeah, it's Satanama.
Because she was really into yoga and Pilates.
Yeah, she was a Pilates instructor and she was very spiritual, very into meditation and things of that nature.
So the account is there. Is it there as kind of a digital memorial to her?
I guess so. That certainly wasn't the intention. It just the idea of taking down these two accounts, just we're not prepared to accept it. And as my sister said in her eulogy to my mom at my mom's funeral, if anyone can figure out how to use the internet from heaven, it would be my mom. So we want to make sure her tools are there for her.
She's outbidding me on a,
yes,
on a,
yes,
on a punch bowl right now.
Yes, she sure is.
What do you think? I mean, you obviously were really close to your mom, and then there was, again, all this stuff she was really into that you mm-hmm. didn't know the full extent of. What do you think you've learned about her here, you know, 2 years later through this stuff?
Well, I learned that she was able to compartmentalize more than I had realized. I didn't realize to the extent that the eBay allowed her to shut off the cancer mentally. I knew that she liked beautiful things and that she had great taste, but I didn't quite understand what an art this Venetian and Steuben glass is. And I also didn't know how important it was to her that my sister and I entertain a lot and beautifully. And that's what we believe the intention of the gift was to, I mean, this woman didn't drink and yet has 300 wine glasses in her house.
She had a vase, I think it was, kind of with your name on it, right?
Well, what happened was in going through her email and her PayPal receipts, I found one receipt that was earmarked. It was the only one that she had added any intention to, and she had written into it Katie's vase and saved it as that. And I had this vase. It was never one of the prettier things in my mind that she had sent me, and I just stuck it on a top shelf in my kitchen and pretty much forgotten about it. But seeing it in her email, I then looked at the date of the purchase, and the date was the day that she was officially diagnosed with lung cancer. Mm-hmm. And it was very powerful for me to know that on this awful, awful, horrible day, she saw something and said, that's for Katie. And it was an incredible, wonderful realization for me. And obviously that vase has catapulted down
yes,
into the family room. And it just was a wonderful project for me, and it's brought me a lot of comfort.
Well, we're going to put a link to your article on our blog, The Bryant Park Project. Also, you can check it out on The Wall Street Journal. I'm sure it's on your website as well. Katie Rossman of The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you
what
very
a
much for
story.
Having me.
Really Thanks. Beautifully written
thank
as well.
Thank you for having me.
We
I appreciate that.
Yeah, you need to read this story, believe me. Speaking of things that are in the news and other places, we have Rachel Martin here. Now, this is the thing. Can we do it without stepping on the sound effect? Let's try. Rachel Martin joins us with some news headlines.
This is NPR.
Awesome.
Hey, everyone. Thanks, Luke. The war in Iraq is not making as much progress as the Bush administration would like. That's the gist of a new report by the Government Accountability Office. Yesterday, the GAO released a controversial report saying the war has failed to meet most of the benchmarks of progress outlined by Congress. But before the report was released, White House and Pentagon officials said it was too harsh, and they pushed for last-minute changes. The GAO rejected several of these suggestions, but the report was recrafted to show partial progress for four benchmarks. Military leaders in Baghdad say the report is flawed and factually incorrect. Toy giant Mattel has announced yet another recall. It's the company's third recall of Chinese-made toys in little more than a month because of excessive amounts of lead paint. The latest recall covers hundreds of thousands of Barbie accessories sold earlier this year. Mattel is developing an advertising and public relations plan to do some damage control ahead of the holiday shopping season. And you may think twice about your butter-flavored popcorn. The nation's largest microwave popcorn maker, ConAgra Foods, says it will change the recipe for its Orville Redenbacher and Act II brands over the next year to remove a flavoring chemical linked to a lung ailment that affects popcorn plant workers. The decision comes a day after a doctor at a leading lung research hospital warned federal regulators that consumers, not just factory workers, may be in danger from fumes from buttery flavoring in microwave popcorn. The chemical has been linked to cases of bronchiolitis obliterans, a rare life-threatening disease often called popcorn lung. Those are the headlines. I'm Rachel Martin.
Thank you, Rachel Martin. After President Bush's surprise trip to Iraq on Monday, he headed to Australia. He arrived Tuesday night, local time, about 10:20 in the evening. No, he wasn't heading there to clean brush on Prime Minister's place. He was slated to attend some of the APEC summit. That's the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, which means just one thing. It's time to bust out a regular Bryant Park Project feature called Make Me Care. It's when we challenge somebody really smart to help us understand why some news event that is important could actually be interesting. And let's see if they can pull this off. Steve Clemens is up. He's a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, director of the Japan Policy Research Institute. Now, before we get started, Steve, what is the APEC Summit? Let's just start there.
It is a summit that was founded in 1989, so what is that, 18 years ago, to bring together leaders of the major countries in the Asia-Pacific region. It's 21 members now. It's grown very large. So that's what it is.
All right, let's do this. We're going to set the clock. Steve Clemens, you have 60
seconds.
This is
a totally unfair challenge.
All right, so when you get close to your 60 seconds, you're going to hear the ticking of the clock come back. That means you have 10 seconds left and then a bomb right now. All right, Steve, APEC Summit, make me care.
The reason people should care is the Asia-Pacific region hosts the most vibrant economies in the world. And this annual leader summit comes up once a year, kind of like, you know, the hand on the clock hitting 4 o'clock. And it forces the United States president, who's been rather obsessed with Iraq and Iran, to think about something else. That's the most important reason that APEC exists, in my view, is to make us think about what's going on in China, its global role. Right now we have all sorts of concerns about toys and product safety standards and food quality in China. We have worries about what Russia is doing. Russia is another member of APEC. And you've got a lot of other nations, Japan, Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, even Chile and Peru and Mexico are APEC members. And they just haven't been in the news. So in my view, it gets the U.S. president there, though I think that people in Sydney, Australia right now wish he hadn't come because it's really, you know, tied up their traffic. But it matters to us because our economy is tied to the Asia-Pacific region, and we're undertending the region right now, and we need to get some greater balance in our foreign policy portfolio.
You know what? You made me care,
yeah,
Steve.
At the end, that stuff about money, that got my attention.
I'm telling you, you may get an NPR mug out of this one.
That was a tough challenge.
Why was it tough, you think?
I think really because we are distracted by Iraq and Iran and what's going on in the Middle East, and it has sucked the air out of our attention of almost any other issue. I mean, there are issues in Africa, Latin America, the region, and, you know, America is one of the few nations in the world that just literally has to be paying attention to other parts of the world. And when we're not there, we're not engaged, bad things happen. Things get out of whack in terms of, you know, right now China is the growing power in the Asia-Pacific region. And, you know, I actually am not anti-China in any way, but it's valuable for the United States to at least be seen to be engaged in trying to tackle with these other countries, whether it's climate change issues or global trade. There are lots of questions out there that need to be solved collaboratively, and we just haven't been at the table because of Iraq and Iran, frankly.
Steve Clemens, you should definitely check out his blog, thewashingtonnote.com.
Link to the Brian Park Project.
Well, we'll link you right back for that one, sir. Thank you so much for playing Make Me Care.
Cool, thank you.
All right, big media fight, Luke.
Yeah.
Not quite David versus Goliath, but more like the cool kids versus the popular kids. In one corner, Apple Technology, worth an estimated $19 billion, the overlord of all things groovy.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC.
Oh, hey, iPod. Nice.
Yeah, it's just a little something to hold my slow jams.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and it works so seamlessly with iTunes.
You should check out iMovie, iPhoto, iWeb, because they all work like iTunes. You know, iLife.
Everything used to work with iTunes. But then in this corner, you have NBC Universal, a multimedia company consisting of theme parks, video sharing sites, record companies, and hit TV shows you can get online.
This is your chance at a normal life.
What you always say when you're about to do something bad.
You don't have to hide everything interesting about you.
No way.
Ah, heroes. Now, the two used to play well together, iTunes selling NBC's content, but now Apple says it won't sell it anymore, so there. Now, NBC says we're taking our ball and going home to our own video site. Who's making the right move here? Nancy Goring from the Newswire IDG joins us. She covers technology from Seattle. Okay, Nancy, what started this fight?
I think it was just an effort by both companies to try to dominate in video sales or to have more control and make more money off of it. So I think Apple is trying to jockey for a similar position as it has in selling digital music, and NBC is hoping to avoid that. I think that the video companies like NBC would prefer that there not be just one digital music store like iTunes, where people can buy videos.
So NBC wants to take all of its new videos off of iTunes, correct?
Well, it's hard to say.
It's hard to figure this one out, I have to be honest.
Yeah, they're saying conflicting things. So Apple, it sounds as though that the negotiations for the new contract have sort of been difficult, and so Apple said that they were not going to sell the upcoming NBC season, and Apple responded by saying, our contract is good through December, so we're selling our shows in iTunes through December. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see what happens when the new shows come out.
I can say that of the one piece of video I've actually downloaded into iTunes, it's The Office from NBC.
I've downloaded 30 Rock.
Well, you know, you're not at a total loss because NBC in October is launching its own site, Hulu.com, with Fox, and you'll be able to get programs through that. And they also said this morning that they're selling programs through Amazon's Unbox, which is another download site.
Now, a lot of this has been playing out in the press. Apple has come out and said, you know what? NBC just wanted to charge you a whole lot more, and that's what we wouldn't agree to. How accurate is that statement?
Well, you know, we've kind of known for a long time that the media companies and even the music companies have wanted variable pricing in iTunes, and Apple has been really adamant that they want to stick with a flat price for all music and all video downloads. So I suspect what happened, and this is what NBC says, is that they were trying to negotiate to do variable pricing, which, you know, analysts say typically means they want to sell, you know, season premieres and stuff like that for a higher price than a regular episode. NBC said they also wanted to design packages of programs so you could buy, you know, five programs for something maybe less than $1.99 each. And Apple has all along been very resistant to variable pricing. So I suspect that was what was going on there. Apple didn't want to give in on variable pricing.
So what does this rift mean for me, the consumer?
Does this work out for me in any way?
Well, if you're an iPod video user, you're bummed if you're a big NBC fan, because you won't be able to download programs onto your iPod. So if you go to Hulu.com or Amazon, you can watch those programs on your PC or certain other video players, but not the iPod.
And that might be a little bit of a drag, considering there's suggestions today that there's going to be a new iPod with a bigger video screen.
Yeah, right, yeah. You know, but I'm kind of on the fence, I have to tell you, about how big of a market this is in the first place. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I mean, it is sort of a relatively small market. I mean, Forrester Research told me recently that in 2007, the overall video download market is supposed to bring in $300 million, which is pretty small. I mean, that's not huge. There's not tons of people really doing this right now, right. You know? So I guess some people are probably going to be pretty bummed out, but I don't know how huge of a deal it is, you know?
Nancy Goring from the Newswire IDG. She covers technology from Seattle. Hey, Nancy, thanks for walking us through that story.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, we're almost at the end of the show, Allie, but I think we would be remiss if we didn't take a moment to really properly welcome our new team member. We even have some musical accompaniment.
Absolutely.
For the occasion.
Rachel is a friend of mine, born and raised on the other side.
You didn't know we had a song commissioned for you, now, did
you?
Groovy.
Yeah. Smooth.
See,
and jazzy.
Can we have that be the news music?
And I'll step on that every time.
Rachel
thanks,
Martin, formerly of NPR Baghdad and NPR Europe and all kinds of places. Welcome to the Bryant Park Project.
Thanks, guys. I'm really happy to be here.
How'd your first day go?
It was up and down.
Yeah?
It was up and down, yeah. But I think, you know, we'll get the hang of this thing. But, you know,
the question is, though, I came off of being a reporter and coming straight here, as did you. And we were talking in the elevator about how hard it is to actually show up at the same place every day and, like, punch in.
Not only that, but look at a clock and realize that literally, like, to the minute, you're going to be doing the same thing every day. So you got to get over that a little bit. But luckily, the news changes every day. So what you talk about is different every day.
Yeah. You're going to probably want to get in the booth like 30 seconds earlier for future reference, because one time we tried to go to you and you weren't there.
Yeah. We did a little IMing like, Rachel, question mark.
Scared.
Well, Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
We're so happy to have you here.
We're very happy to have you here.
Thanks, guys.
I'm going to go to my desk and listen to that awesome song, that Rachel song that I found on iTunes today. This has been the Bryant Park Project. Allison, why don't you run through the names this
time? All right.
Can you
I have my glasses on, so
okay.
I hope I don't miss anybody.
Dan, I'll feed you. Dan.
Dan Pashman, directing.
MJ.
MJ Davis, producer extraordinaire.
Sharon Hoffman.
Our new executive producers.
Matt Martinez
skulking in the hall right now, but also senior supervising producer and skulker.
Ilya Maritz,
brand new person. Fit in right nicely this week.
Manoli Weatherall.
We love Manoli.
Neil Rausch
on the board.
And Rachel Martin. God, can we talk about her a little bit more? I'm Luke Burbank.
I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.